From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The sacred and the secular. In the history of art and ideas, from antiquity into the modern world, how do these combine and diverge to form patterns of religious and social behavior and thought? That question is central to the following Soundings discussion, the second in a series of conversations about communicating the sacred in words and images. The Soundings panelists are Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg, both of Duke University, where Anne Epstein is an art historian and Robert Gregg is a professor in the Divinity School. During her recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Anne Epstein collaborated with Robert Gregg on a project combining art history and literary analysis as methods of understanding early Christian culture in the Mediterranean basin between the 3rd and the 5th centuries. According to Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg, there are a number of ways to approach this understanding. Among them, early Mediterranean Christian expressions of divine power and divine agents, concepts of community, the lives of martyrs and ascetics, and preoccupations with death and mortal consolation. Here is Anne Epstein.
This is a period in which it's very difficult to distinguish the sacred from the secular. Such a distinction, I don't think, would make much sense to the people at that time. And one of the things that interests me as an art historian, concerned with the meaning of images, is that images in this period had an enormous amount of power of the sort that they have lost since. In images, there resided spirit. A spirit which had power. This spirit which had considerable power was lent the image, obviously, by the community. They assumed that the image could work. And in fact, some of the best stories about images from the early Christian period are about pagan images or idols. So for example, when John of Ephesus went to Ephesus to attempt to convert the pagan city to Christianity, he was confronted there with an entrenched priesthood whose cults centered on the Artemis of Ephesus, who, according to local tradition, had been dropped from heaven.
Now, this is a Greek deity.
This is a Greek deity, a female deity, a multi-breasted deity. There are still many images available of her in Ephesus.
Not to mention the 1980s.
Right. But in any case, when he actually confronted this idol, the idol acknowledged his power, whispering to her priests that this was a person of greater sacredness and power than she was. And at that point, the priests were converted to Christianity themselves, so, took the image and dragged it through the streets, and the populace yelled at the image, "You weren't made in heaven. You were made in the bronze casting craftsman's workshop." But it's not as though this image didn't have power. Its power was less than the Christian holy man.
So what we're talking about here, Bob Gregg, Anne Epstein, is not so much a division of the sacred and the secular in this 3rd through the 5th centuries as a kind of hierarchy, almost like chocolate swirl ice cream.
Well, and also competition of sacred items, persons, agents, priests, from a later period in which the entire battlefield of competition is Christian, that is, separate Christian groups. In 6th and 7th century Gaul, or later to be France, we know of, for example, great miracles attached to the shrine of a 4th century martyr, Martin of Tours. People came to the shrine of Martin, and one particular story underlines just how concrete and material this question of the sacred could become. A king whose son was dying came in a kind of desperation move to the shrine at Tours, hoping that the power of the bones of Martin would cure his son. Many others had tried this and had succeeded, but there was a difficulty. This king was a Christian, but not an Orthodox Christian, rather an Arian Christian, and all of his attempts to gain the help of the martyred Saint Martin for his son's recovery were vain, because he would not give the correct profession of faith. But when he did, it was possible for him to take a silk cloth, lay it over the tomb which contained the remains of Saint Martin, and leave that cloak on this tomb overnight. When he took it off the next day, his lieutenants weighed this silken garment and noticed that the grace that had flowed from the remains of Martin into the silk garment cloak had increased its weight immeasurably. Now, that's fairly physical evidence of, in one sense, the ancient world doesn't concentrate so much on the element of believing. I was really using this story to point to the fact that, in one sense, in the ancient world, in the period we're talking about, the sacred is that which demonstrably delivers power, delivers on its promises.
In other words, Bob Gregg, Anne Epstein, we're talking here about the communication of the sacred. Now, the time period is the 3rd through the 5th century, not the 1980s. But my sense is that human nature doesn't change that much. Are you telling me that people were somehow or other more capable of belief in this period because of what Anne Epstein called the power of these images? I'm a little confused, Anne.
That's a very interesting question, and I think one has to consider the differences in society now than then. One of those elements, there must be hundreds, thousands of differences, but one of the things that strikes me as a major contributor to the level of spirituality of late antiquity and, in fact, throughout the Middle Ages, is that the community was still largely an oral community. That is, ideas, everyday problems, general social intercourse was verbal and immediate between you and me. Literature certainly was a very important part of the society. It's one by which we know the society, one of the important means by which we know the society. It was a society which strangely, despite its orality, privileged the written word insofar as the Gospels were seen as the nexus of truth. So here we have an oral culture in which literary texts are particularly important. How do you communicate that? And I think partially because of this slight contradiction, things like sermons, which were popular discourse in some senses, and images as a means of visually communicating the truths that were embodied in sacred texts, take on a great deal more prominence in the process of relations.
All right, Bob Gregg, Anne Epstein, you are discussing for me the communication of the sacred in word and in image. Here before me, I have a brief description of your joint project. You say that you are addressing questions, you're focusing upon ceremonies of initiation, for example, representations of power in deities and divine agents, texts and contexts of ascetic practice and attitudes and actions concerning death. Let's take, well, maybe the most fascinating and morbid of those, death. Discuss this for me. How was this, what, process or act or element, how did it become represented? Why was it connected to the sacred in, again, our time period here is the 3rd through the 5th centuries in the Mediterranean world? Bob?
A whole range of issues surround the problem of mortality, as you might imagine. One of the, well, let me just talk about the way in which we are trying to approach this. You could, in looking at the way in which death is regarded, talked about, analyzed in the ancient world, you could simply look at the fairly formal sermons and funeral orations given by Christian leaders or pagan orators. and simply look at the cluster of ideas, mostly philosophical, which are used to address the problem of life's end, loss of loved ones, whether there is credible hope, or whether the proper attitude in the face of death is resignation. What we are trying to do is simply to put those kinds of formal literary responses to the fact of death alongside all the other things which would have made up a community's or a family's experience of the loss of someone.
Mm-hmm.
The actual rituals accompanying the disposition of the body, the procession placed, the dead body is placed, the returns to that site by the family members on a periodic and cyclical basis. And one of the things we're trying to do is simply get some fairly serious detailed mm-hmm. readings of how many elements made up a group's or a family's experience.
Well, your object here, again, is not to conceptualize what's
We're
going on
writing.
Or intellectualize, but to yes. see it as you said, you know, a sort of videotape of the way people lived.
We're not interested so much in this case in dealing with an episode in the history of ideas about death. We're trying to fill in the picture
mm-hmm.
of what a community did mm-hmm. to make sense of the mm-hmm. of the experience of death in this or that setting mm-hmm. and time.
Anne Epstein?
One of the things that Bob and I are centrally concerned with is not the text per se, not the object per se, but the reconstruction of the interaction
between
all those things. That uh-huh. is social action, society. Society is not a matter of facts, it's not a matter of text, it's not a matter of objects, it's a matter of how these things relate to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And just one point on method, I think we're both struggling to find out how we can get as much juice out of each of these facts
yeah.
in reconstituting social interaction as we possibly can. But one of the things that's helped me, at least, is a lot of reader response criticism, for instance, which puts the emphasis off the text as such onto either the reader or the author.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, what I'm trying to use this material, which is, of course, way outside our territorial and temporal range, to do is to help me see how I can reconstruct audience, that is, the society, on the basis of what remains, whether it's archaeological remains, mm-hmm. whether it's texts, or whether it's artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're trying to do is use all modes,
all
media
data.
Mm-hmm.
at our command in trying to get a sense of how richly textured this remote society is,
mm-hmm.
and in its remoteness, nevertheless, how responsive we can be to it, because the problems that people had then are the same problems that people have now.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the concluding segment in a series of discussions about communicating the sacred in words and images. The Soundings panelists are Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg of Duke University, where Anne Epstein is an art historian and Robert Gregg is a professor in the School of Divinity. During her fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Anne Epstein collaborated with Robert Gregg on a project combining art history and literary analysis as methods of understanding early Christian culture in the Mediterranean basin. According to Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg, an interdisciplinary analysis of Mediterranean culture in the 3rd through the 5th centuries yields important new insights into early Christian expressions of divine power, concepts of community, the lives of martyrs and ascetics, and preoccupations with death and mortal consolation. Anne Epstein, Bob Gregg, our topic is the communication of the sacred in word and in image. Your time period is the 3rd through the 5th centuries in the Mediterranean world. Some of my questions, because of this, the richness that Anne Epstein has just described, some of the things that I've asked you about have been necessarily naive. Let me be necessarily cynical here. One temptation would be for me to say, you're not really talking about the sacred, you're not talking about the gods, and you're not talking about divine spiritual authority. What you're talking about is human politics, and who's going to run the world. And the people, images don't create themselves. People create images. People create texts and words, and they use them to certain, I guess a crude word here would be political end, or various political ends. Am I being overly cynical there?
One of my major concerns in my work has been to demonstrate how objects, monuments, physical realities act as ideological vehicles. Mm-hmm. That is, they represent the desires, whether they're political or whatever, material desires of the people who produce them. What I'm also very much interested in is not just how a patron puts forward his political perspectives in a work of art, which has been a traditional subject of interest to art historians, but also how that was received by the audience that looked at it. Mm-hmm. Again, in contrast to our own day, where art is hung, or high art is hung on gallery walls, and a certain segment of society goes to those galleries and looks at art dutifully as part of their cultural experience. Art in the early Christian period, in the High Middle Ages, art was popular culture, as part of the popular culture. Mm-hmm. Church art, art in the great cathedrals of the early Christian period, was mass consumption art.
It was both. It was instructive. It was aesthetic.
It was didactic, mm-hmm. and it was dogmatic. It told stories and it revealed truths. Mm-hmm. But underneath those specific and truths were implicit truths about hierarchy, social hierarchy, ecclesiastical hierarchy, the fact that you should pay your tithes on time, all these other little problems. But it's not just the fact that the patron presented those, which mm-hmm. seems obvious to me, but also how the audience responded to them mm-hmm. that's interesting. Mm-hmm. How were they received? What kind of reciprocity affected those images? That is, the patron is not going to put something on the wall that he doesn't think is going to work.
Right.
So he can't just put what he wants
it's
there.
It's like spending advertising dollars today.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. He can't just put what he wants there. He has to put only what he knows will be accepted.
Mm-hmm. Bob, Greg?
Well, I noticed that we have circled back in a curious way to Wayne's original question about whether one could distinguish between sacred and secular in the 3rd to 5th centuries, which are the focus of our work. And as we talk about the way in which art functioned in that period, I'm immediately reminded of the way in which the presence of the emperor at a hearing in which you are engaged in negotiations with a representative of the empire, the presence of the portrait of the emperor behind one of his legal representatives indicates the presence of someone who is not simply the person who stands at the top of the legal structure, but also the one who is God-directed, God-protected, and the one with whom you must deal if you are to deal with the gods. So we are not talking about images which really can be categorized as either mm-hmm. sacred or secular, mm-hmm. and we are not really talking about an age in which you can distinguish between religious truth and just plain politics.
Mm-hmm. Anne Epstein?
Well, there's no doubt to me that images, symbols, have immense power. Certainly, before my daughter could speak or talk, she would recognize the golden arches of McDonald's mm-hmm. and have the proper response to those arches. That is what they were meant to act as. Mm-hmm. Combining this question with the question of relevance to modern society, or how different we are from the past. I was just, as before the program, as we were getting some coffee here at the National Humanities Center, we were talking about the recent Duke University Chapel Hill UNC basketball game, and several of the people having coffee mentioned that they had done certain things to make sure that their team won, worn a specific sweater, not gone off for coffee when their team was behind.
Now we are talking about the sacred.
Yeah, the sacred. And what struck me in that brief interchange was how we all still, despite our rationality and the fact that we will laugh at our little habits,
right,
have our amulets by which we protect ourselves, mm-hmm, our little gimmicks to make sure that that what happens, happens as we want it to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So below that rational surface lingers some sense that control can be exerted through concrete action, that is ritual, mm-hmm, or things.
Yeah, expressive culture,
yeah,
whether it's pictures or words.
Right.
Anne Epstein and Bob Gregg, both of Duke University, we're talking about the communication of the sacred in words and in pictures. Your time period is early Christianity, the Mediterranean world. Let's be a little bit fanciful. We're on the radio. We don't have pictures at our disposal. We don't have that advantage. But let me ask each of you to briefly sort of wander down the streets of a Mediterranean, what do you call these things, villages or community, social unit of some sort?
Cities.
Cities. What am I going to see? What do you see? Pick one very specific sort of element that communicates the sacred, and tell me how that works, how the dynamic between the object, the people who see it, the impressions that the creators wish to convey, and what the audiences might have felt. I'd like each of you to take a shot at that. Anne, would you begin?
Well, I think probably at the end of my year's research, I'll be able to answer such a question a little more palpably than I can now. But one, as an art historian, of course, I've done a lot of traveling. It's a great advantage to wander through what does remain on a site and rebuild in your imagination what was once there. Perhaps one of the most spectacular sites of this early Christian practice of religiosity, to my knowledge, is Kalatsiman, a site on the far eastern edges of the Syrian desert, not too far from Antioch, although once you're there, it seems as though it could never have been anywhere close to any city. The site is the site where the holy man Simeon sat on a column 40 cubits high for 40 years.
Goodness.
This was a man who I don't think was literate, but whose practice of asceticism, his denial of himself, his body, the material life, allowed him a proximity to God which created him, made him a vessel of sacredness. He did everything with this sacredness that any community could hope to have done. He brought rain. He healed the sick. He converted the masses.
Arbitrated disputes.
Arbitrated disputes.
So this was an active relationship between this individual and the community.
Absolutely. However, And of course, remember, this is so remote, and yet masses of pilgrims came to the site. But what's equally as interesting, that even after he died and his body was taken to Antioch as a relic, his site retained its sacredness. So pilgrims continued to come.
Sort of soaked it up, and there was a transference there.
Right. Uh-huh. So when a modern pilgrim comes, that sacredness is still residual.
Uh-huh. Bob Gregg, how about you? What do you see as you wander through one of these Mediterranean cities? What's sacred? How does it get communicated to whom?
Well, I want to be as selective as your question gives me the luxury of being.
Mm-hmm.
I want to look at three things in the city of Rome out of literally thousands of things that the eye would meet. I would like to concentrate in my walk on the shrine, the holy place of the healer deity Asclepius in Rome, and note that doctors, practitioners of medicine, have set up their shops just outside of this shrine of the god Asclepius.
They're sort of borrowing some authority. Yes. Is that right?
Well, they're in the zone in which that kind of sacred help can be delivered.
Today we call them hospitals.
Right.
After a fashion. What else do you see?
Well, then I walk to a... this is a little trickier. If we're talking about the 4th century, I can walk to an actual above-ground and identifiable Christian building.
Uh-huh.
And when I walk into this place, I can tell from its appointments in the interior that it is a place where Christians worship and do liturgy. But it is also clear, from looking at the activity in this place in the late 4th century, that all kinds of other communal business gets attended to in that place. The negotiation of divorces, disputes, even business transactions, the allocation of funds for people who are impoverished and in need. And then if I leave that place, which is also like the Asclepium, a place of serious and intense human activity, and walk up to the top of the Palatine Hill, I find a graffito, a really interesting graffito, which perhaps brings these two worlds together. There is an interesting graffito in which there is depicted a figure who is crucified, who has in the place of a human head the head of a donkey. And underneath this figure is a person clearly in a worshipful posture, and a little inscription that says, Alexa Menas worships his god. The graffito is understood by most people who have worried about it to be a poking of fun or a ridicule of a Christian who worships this crucified one, probably by a hostile person. And one of the really interesting things in this period that we're concerned with is precisely that tension and competition between two systems with competing claims for sacred power in its midst.
Mm-hmm. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the concluding segment in a series of conversations about communicating the sacred in words and images. The topic of the preceding discussion was early Christian culture in the Mediterranean in the 3rd through the 5th centuries. The Soundings panelists were Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg of Duke University. During her fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Anne Epstein collaborated with Robert Gregg in the writing of a forthcoming book about communicating the sacred in words and images. For a cassette copy of Soundings with Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the first in a series of conversations about love, marriage, friendship, and sexuality in classical antiquity. The Soundings panelists will include scholars from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Northwestern, Princeton, and Stanford universities. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for part 2 of Communicating the Sacred in Words and Images. The Soundings panelists will be Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg of Duke University. In their forthcoming study, Anne Epstein and Robert Gregg combine art history and literary analysis as methods for better understanding of early Christian culture in the Mediterranean basin. Communicating the Sacred in Words and Images, Part 2, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center, on this station.